Between 6 and 11 December on 1931, a remarkable meeting occurred between the French intellectual Romain Rolland, Madeleine Slade, the daughter of a British admiral, and Mahatma Gandhi. It took place in the Frenchman's villa in Villeneuve, Switzerland, after the failure of the Second Roundtable Conference on India in London. Despite British recognition that an all-Indian self-governing federation was inevitable, the negotiations had been unable to agree on minority representation for Muslims, Sikhs, and untouchables. The Swiss meeting, in contrast, was supposed to be relaxing, even reassuring, a long-awaited private encounter between two men who had corresponded for several years. Slade was there as an intimate of both men and had been literally given by the Frenchman as a gift to the Indian national leader. And here she is on the boat with Gandhi on the way to Europe. The meeting reached its climax not when discussing Mussolini or the Soviet Union, but when Rolland played Gandhi's Beethoven's Fifth Symphony on the phonograph. Slade, a music lover who had not heard Beethoven since she had left for India, was deeply moved. But when Rolland asked Gandhi his impression, he responded with a little laugh, both candid and mischievous. He said, "It must be beautiful because you tell me so." For Gandhi, Beethoven was unfamiliar, and the so-called mischievous laughter implied a polite rejection of an elitist and Western universalism in taste. But for the two Europeans, Beethoven was not to be dismissed in an offhand remark. For Rolland, his music embodied the so-called oceanic sensibility, the basis of his aesthetic and political creed, and the closest he came to a spiritual position. For Slade, the music was the medium through which he experienced human love and passion. The divergence of opinion on music, in fact, summarized the entire meeting and signaled a parting of the ways between two men who had hoped desperately to find common ground. So why bother with the meeting of a French intellectual, an English lady, and an Indian nationalist? The reason lies in the way all three used spirituality and aesthetics to try and navigate the great political realignments and crises of conscience that the interwar period threw up. Slade was essential to both, a translator literally and figuratively. Her efforts embodied the hopes and dreams of her fathers, that's what she called them. The torments she suffered symbolized the immense difficulties the two men experienced in trying to understand each other. She threw off the spinsterly domesticity that her upper-class pedigree had decreed for her, and her trajectory reveals how passion, desire, and personal power could mingle in the larger discussion of world political systems, novel social experiments, and individual spiritualities. The way the great men treated her demonstrates not only her ambiguous position and indeed ultimately her subordination, but also Gandhi's troubling impact on intimates who sought to embody his utopian vision of liberation. Slade was the daughter of the distinguished Admiral Sir Edmund Slade, one-time Commander-in-Chief of the East India Station and a board member of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. She maintained that until her arrival in India in 1925, at the age of 33, she knew nothing of the subcontinent. This was not the case. In fact, India was a familiar place where she had hosted local elite women at purdah parties and ridden horses with the imperial classes. After World War I, she refused marriage to become a concert impresario, using her own income to bring the Scottish pianist Frederick Lammond over from Berlin to give recitals of Beethoven, designed to foster British-German rapprochement. The concerts were successful musically, but Slade fell in love with her pianist, a married man with children. She fled from her feelings, first to Bonn, Beethoven's birthplace, and then to France and Switzerland, as she wanted to meet Rolland, who had written a best-selling biography of the composer. Now, Rolland, for his part, had won the Nobel Prize in 1915 for his famous novel Jean-Christophe, no longer read, but at the time considered a masterpiece, a multi-volume work that focused on a composer, not unlike Beethoven, who escapes the rigidity of Germany by going to Paris, where he meets Rolland's alter ego, Olivier Genin, a French intellectual. When their friendship is tested by the second Morocco crisis, both rise above the nationalism that is drawing Europe ineluctably to war. The Nobel Prize was awarded only months after his famous anti-war polemic, Au-dessus de la mêlée, condemned nationalism as a form of barbarism, and brought Roland widespread abuse from his own countrymen for his bochophilie and defeatism. And that's why he ends up in Switzerland. Although known as the so-called conscience of Europe, Roland was an unconventional French intellectual. His public Germanophilia combined with a private anti-Semitism. He divorced his French wife, Clotilde Préal, a French Jewess from a family of noted Dreyfusards. And I'm sure Professor Johnson would be glad that there is something on the Dreyfus affair. He had refused to engage in the affair because of what he saw as the political opportunism of both camps, and produced his play Les Loups to present the arguments of both sides. Although a succès de scandale, the work pleased no one and revealed a lingering anti-Semitism that he later only completely abjured in 1940 in the wake of the defeat. Before World War I, Roland mixed a theatrical populism, he wanted to bring high culture to the masses, with an almost Nietzschean obsession with literary and artistic genius, producing works on Handel and Michelangelo, as well as the 1903 biography of Beethoven. He also saw himself as a disciple of Tolstoy, although his adoration of Anna Karenina was matched by his distaste for the communitarianism, embrace of poverty, and stripped-down Christian ethics presented in What is to be Done. Roland rejected Tolstoy's claim that asceticism was the true path to spiritual redemption, and defended art against the accusation that it was the product of injustice. Gandhi and Roland both revered Tolstoy, but while the Frenchman loved the art and was skeptical of the politics and religion, the Indian admired the politics and religion but had no time for the art. When Slade finally met Roland in 1923, she told him of her longings for a new life. Roland talked about his forthcoming volume on Gandhi, and she was instantly enthralled. Both were looking for a new spiritual and political course in the post-World War I era. Both believed they had found what they were looking for in Gandhi. For the Frenchman, the enthusiasm was part of a longer meditation on Western decadence and the rise of Pan-Asianism. Like so many European intellectuals, Roland was bowled over by the myriad-minded prodigiousness of Rabindranath Tagore. The first non-European to win the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1913. In 19, Tagore had famously gone to Japan and addressed the Japanese. He denounced the brutality of World War I, stressed the importance of Eastern traditions, and warned against the wholesale adoption of Western values. Roland regarded the Bengali intellectual as his Eastern alter ego. East and West, he told Tagore, were, quote, two hemispheres of the same brain of humanity, both essential to prevent the world's degeneration. They agreed on the primacy of the individual and the importance of art, and these concerns split them off from Gandhi. As early as 1922, the historian Kalidas Nag realized that both Roland and Tagore, quote, upheld the principle of the absolute liberty of the individual, while Gandhi required the individuals to submit to, quote, the tactics of the masses. Tagore and Roland found it difficult to comprehend Gandhi's individualistic populism and doubted his, quote, ascetic, violently monastic tastes. Indeed, Tagore didn't believe that Indians should be ascetic anymore, but that asceticism should be imposed on the West so that the West would no longer be violent. But they jointly fashioned the Mahatma cults. It is they who made Gandhi into the Mahatma to stay in the new political mainstream. And it's for that reason that Roland takes up the torch and writes for the West about Gandhi. They appreciated Gandhi's political acumen, revitalization of Indian society, and nonviolent methods, and wanted to see his efforts as part of the same Eurasian collaboration that animated them. And there they are together in the Villa Olga. There's as many pictures of Tagore in England with similar types of intellectuals as there is of Tagore with people in France. Strangely, though, Rollo and his correspondents, both Eastern and Western, were still vaguely inspired by Indo-Aryan mythologies reminiscent of Taine and Renan. Edmond Privat, an eminent Swiss Esperantist and pacifist, as well as Roland's intimate, followed Gandhi and Slade back to the subcontinent because both classical Greece and India were, in his words, ancient homelands founded by our Aryan ancestors. Kalidas Nag told Roland how he and his fellow Bengalis had read Jean-Christophe and discovered the almost textual reiteration of, quote, old Vedic hymns to Vishnu and Siva in its epic and metaphysical passages. Roland responded only half in jest that he must have somehow been the descendant of the, quote, last offshoot of the Aryan avant-garde, now, quote, lost among the Negro and Semitic races of the Occident. This remark reveals the lingering Indo-Aryanism and racialism that still structured Roland's view of civilization, indeed structured the Bengali's view of civilization as well. He remained ambivalent about the French Empire and Islam, and after World War I stood back from the radicalism of both Leninist and Wilsonian calls for the eclipse of global European hegemony. Moreover, he sided with the socialists when the left split in France, with communists becoming anti-imperialists and socialists remaining keen on colonial uplift and reform. The Rif War showed his ambiguous position. When Moroccan Berbers raided French posts in a guerrilla conflict during the 1920s, Roland justified a French military response because of the need to save Algeria, while he recognized, quote, the absolute moral justice of the oppressed races. He maintained that Rif's proximity to Fez might compromise Algeria's security. France could not undermine her, quote, African empire. If France flinches, her entire conquest totters. All of Islam rises up, and who can calculate the ruins, not only for France, but for Europe? Indeed, he appreciated Islamic culture much less than its Hindu counterpart, seemed uninterested in Christian-Islamic links, and never questioned Republican universalism. Fearful that nationalist violence might destabilize the rest of the British Empire as well as India, he turned to Gandhi, because the Mahatma seemed a conciliatory alternative to the more uncompromising Bal Gangadhar Tilak or Sri Aurobindo, the more radical Indian nationalist leaders. By stopping the so-called imperialism of arms and money and allowing Europe to call on, quote, the cooperation of the oppressed races, Roland hoped that Gandhism would arrest the West's inexorable march towards catastrophe. Gandhism, Roland hoped, would also alter his own standing. He no longer wanted to be regarded as, quote, above the fray, au-dessus de la mêlée, even though he was in Switzerland, literally above the fray, and was troubled when the anti-war novelist Henri Barbusse and other communists saw his refusal to take the side of the revolution as a sign of incorrigible elitism. Barbusse's epithet, Rolandisme, became an insult to be hurled at those who preferred so-called bourgeois conscience to revolutionary struggle. Still, Roland did reject dialectical materialism, feared the systematic persecution of dissidents in the new Soviet Union, and remained committed to free criticism. By supporting Gandhi, he aimed to outflank left-wing criticism by championing an alternative which was just as effective, if not more so. He called him the Indian St. Francis of Assisi, who, Roland claimed, had, quote, raised 3 million, shaking the British Empire and inaugurating the most powerful movement in politics for 2,000 years. Roland's biography of Gandhi described in awed terms the graded campaigns after World War I, the non-cooperation movement, resignations from the civil service, police and army, a tax strike, a boycott of schools, courts, and foreign goods. Gandhi drew in social groups and regions hitherto untouched by the national struggle, producing a political movement that stunned the British with its tactical originality and scope, and which owed little to the currents of left-wing European thought. For Roland, the best demonstration of this came with Gandhi's reaction to the 1922 riot in Chauri Chora in Uttar Pradesh, when 26 protesters were shot and over 20 policemen burnt alive. Gandhi called off the campaign, arguing that India was not ready for independence, and undertook a fast to atone for the violence. By repenting for transgressions that were not his own, he offered himself as a religious sacrifice. Gandhi always maintained that his presence was incidental to the national awakening, but the way he shut the campaign down showed just how powerful he was. It also hinted at the contradictions, which were very profound, in a populist egalitarian movement which depended so much on a single individual. Neither Slade nor Roland were concerned by the essentially liberalism and paternalism that often infuriated Gandhi's close colleagues. Slade, in particular, had no doubts about decisions which relied on Gandhi's so-called inner voice. Rather, she was so entranced that she decided to become his disciple. When she read about Gandhi's 21-day fast for Hindu-Muslim unity in October 1924, she sold her diamond brooch. It was the only thing left to her after giving up all her fortune for the concert performances, and sent £20 along with a letter asking to join him. Gandhi wrote back and invited her to come, but warned her that the climate was challenging and the labor strenuous. She was not deterred. She learned to spin, took Urdu lessons, and became a vegetarian and teetotaler. Then, with little money left, no husband, and without formal education, she abandoned everything, sailed for India, and became a part of his entourage for the rest of his life. In his diary entry of 15 September 1924, Roland wrote of Slade as his gift to the Mahatma. He was, quote, the instrument of her destiny, glad that she had sublimated unrequited love into a passion for a, quote, new Christ. He described her as a, quote, a young novice, a Carmelite, embarking on an exercise in which Christian and Hindu models of asceticism would overlap. Gandhi in turn wrote that he would make her, quote, the bridge between East and West. Neither felt any qualms about heaping such grandiose expectations on her psychically fragile shoulders. Meeting Gandhi was like an epiphany for Slade. She wrote, as I entered, a slight brown figure rose up and came toward me. I was conscious of nothing but a sense of light. I fell on my knees. Hands gently raised me up, and a voice said, you shall be my daughter. She integrated herself into the ashram's routine, embraced the harshest asceticism, and reveled in his attempts to turn her into, quote, a common village girl. She determined to be celibate, as Gandhi believed that the sexual urge was related to violence, relinquished her full sari for a more humble half sari, and even wanted to cut off her hair, a wish opposed by the other women of the ashram who considered it to be attention-seeking. But because she wanted it so much, Gandhi cut it off with his own hands and renamed her after Mirabai. From now on, I will call her Miraben. That's what she was, basically, for the rest of her life. The 16th century disciple of Lord Krishna. Slade was prepared to renounce everything except a special relationship with Gandhi. This, however, caused an incessant struggle that was never resolved. The inspirations that Gandhi imbibed from three continents convey some sense of the spiritual and political amalgam he created. They demonstrate, too, how very different was his world of imperial connection and Indian diaspora to that of the essentially European and still Cartesian Roland, no matter what he said. As a child, Gandhi worshipped Vishnu as the supreme god in the temples of his native Gujarat, and practice bhakti ideals dedicated to surrendering absolutely to God. The greatest scriptural influence was the Bhagavad Gita, though he first read it in English through London Theosophist contacts. Through his mother and his mentor, Raishan Bai, he encountered Jainism, a creed focused on nonviolence, spiritual detachment, and extreme bodily discipline. He admired Buddha, met Theosophists while in London, and ate in vegetarian restaurants, encounters that all contributed to his almost New Age style of spiritual experimentation, which was his favorite word. His political tactics were forged in the crucible of South Africa, where after working primarily for the Muslim merchant class, he encountered Indian indentured laborers and realized that to South Africans, whites, all Indians were untouchables. Missionaries educated him in Christian doctrine, and he remained forever impressed by the Sermon on the Mount. Ruskin's Unto the Last gave him the idea of so-called soul force as a substitute for violence and offered a new collective economic program based on manual labor. He came into contact with Tolstoy in 1908 when the novelist wrote to the Free Hindustan newspaper wondering why, quote, 200 million people, highly gifted, both physically and mentally, bow to a small group of people quite alien to them in thought and immeasurably inferior to them in religious morality. Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within You, quote, overwhelmed Gandhi with its, quote, independent thinking, profound morality, and truthfulness. When he set up Phoenix Farm in South Africa, his first sort of ashram, he made everyone in the community read it, and his next cooperative venture was named after the novelist. Tolstoy, in return, congratulated Gandhi for his Hind Swaraj, or Indian Home Rule, which condemned Western civilization while promoting, quote, passive resistance and Indian self-reliance. It demonstrated both his debt to Tolstoy, but also his radical departure from the Russian Christian pacifism. His idea of nonviolence, ahimsa, brought to the fore, quote, the moral dimension of all action. He emphasized pity, tenderness, and mercy, but he also recognized that it entailed the use of moral pressure in situations of conflict. Based on provoking violence in one side in order to highlight it, its absence in the other, it revealed the intimate relationship between himsa and ahimsa. In condemning oppression and opposing coercion, individuals build character through the purification of suffering. This so-called satyagraha, or soul force, was a powerful weapon, one that should be deployed without fear or loss of life. Self-rule, or swaraj, emerged from a sacrificial and interlinked disciplining of both individuals and society. But this account, in my view, underestimates the role of Gandhi's own peculiar psychology and the creative way he sought to combine passivity and aggression in one irresistible force. His asceticism drew strength from Indian sannyasi traditions of transcendental detachment, but differed in insisting upon this worldly engagement, sustained by the minute regulation of all bodily functions. He differed from previous Hindu ascetic thinkers by urging that celibacy should even be practiced in marriage, and departed from Indian tradition in believing that men were more naturally sexual, and hence more inherently aggressive than women. In 1938, he confessed to Mirabin that he had experienced a nocturnal emission after years of self-control. Utterly shaken and close to a nervous breakdown as a result, he felt unequal to the task of engaging in tricky negotiations with Pakistan's future leader, Jinnah. When communal rioting exploded prior to partition, Gandhi, against the wishes of his political advisors, slept naked with his grandniece, Manu, just as he intended his fasting to bring contrition for aggressive acts. He believed that resisting sexual temptation would stop Muslims and Hindus from murdering one another. And although they kept on asking him to stop, he did not stop. So why, amidst all of this, did Gandhi spend so much time and trouble on the lost daughter of a British admiral? Certainly, as an astute politician, he saw the symbolic value of adopting and converting a woman from the imperial elite. But he also wished to guide her and had always chosen intimate companions to further his experiments with truth. That is the subtitle of his biography, Experiments with Truth. In South Africa, Jews such as Henry and Millie Pollock and the bodybuilder and architect Herman Kallenbach were key to Phoenix and Tolstoy Farms, Indeed, it's in their remarkable correspondence, Gandhi calls himself Upper House and Hermann Kallenbach Lower House. It's because Kallenbach took care of basically all the physical dimensions of all their activities. He was also Gandhi's bodyguard. Powerful European and Indian women, as well as male Indian disciples, were all close collaborators. But no other Western woman was as close as Mirabai, and no other vexed him like she did. Gandhi disliked intimacy on principle and proclaimed, for reasons that went deep into his past, that, quote, intimate friendship was undesirable because the desire for merger inevitably created dangerous instability. Friendship was, as he put it, the identity of souls, a connection of equals, nevertheless based on clear boundaries, like Hindu-Muslim friendship in the political realm. And indeed, his notion of friendship was very, very important to his whole political philosophy. But Mirabai could not keep within these boundaries. A lovelorn child raised by nannies, a distant father, and an elusive mother, she clung to Gandhi to fill her intense yearning for affection. Moreover, Gandhi was ambiguous in his so-called friendships. He presented himself as an ever-present and ever-loving Bapu, but rejected the role of guru and demanded never-ending service. Hanging out his laundry while at Villeneuve, Mirabai told Roland of the inflexible control, those were her words, that Gandhi, so forbearing with the shortcomings of opponents, imposed on those closest to him. He was, I'm afraid, a martinet, and frightened her with his almost clairvoyant penetration and implacability. While her vulnerability touched him, her needs infuriated him. His letters to her shifted between exhortations to courage and exasperation at her almost leech-like hold upon him. He wrote to her, "Do throw off the nervousness," he begged her. "You must not cling to me as in this body. The spirit without the body is ever with you, and that is all we need." She tried to detach herself, failed, and broke down when he sent her away to learn Hindi, which she never mastered. But Mirabai was not just a drain. She regulated his food, turned away the many food offerings, and performed the long bathing and massage rituals so dear to him. She was able, like no one else, to soothe the never-resting and often pain-racked body. Ascetic herself and fearful of her own sexual feelings, she grasped Gandhi's obsessive desire to ward off pollution and protect himself from sin. Although it was almost unendurable, she also denied herself food when he undertook his epic fast and was frequently scolded by him for it. Indeed, their connection was so close that her prescience could overwhelm him. She worried that the continual clamor around him would make him collapse. And in the spring of 1927, he did indeed suffer an apoplectic attack that almost killed him. His so-called love letters sought to calm her, but when she rushed to him unbidden, she received a terrible reprimand. In later years, she reflected upon the seesaw dynamic that governed their relationship. Quote, "Bapu wanted her to be perfect and yet to be herself. The two things just did not fit." The nature of their interaction and the general tohu-bohu that circulated around Gandhi could not be more different to the style adopted by Roland, whose intense relationships occurred on paper so that his valetudinarianism would not be disrupted. He too met with rebuffs during the 1920s, even though his relationship to Gandhi was less tempestuous. When he wrote of Théophile and Félix Bertalon, two Protestant brothers from the Alps who had evaded the draft during World War I, he was horrified that Gandhi would not include their story in Young India. The brothers had hidden in the mountains for 13 years, given up meat, and read the Bible 87 times. But because they had escaped prison, Gandhi concluded they were not true Satyagrahis. What Roland saw as doctrinal narrowness, Gandhi and Slade regarded as Roland's misconstrual, a fundamental misconstrual, and Gandhi and Slade were right, of the tactics of nonviolence. The fact that they tried to evade capture for so long was proof that this was, in their eyes, not the real thing. The criticism, however, went both ways, When in his autobiography, Gandhi sought to justify it serialized in the 1920s, his decision in World War I to support the empire in exchange for concessions. Roland was outraged. He understood a die-hard nationalist who killed and pitied a weak man drafted into the struggle, but was impatient with a man of so-called, quote, great courage, of absolute faith, who compromised himself in such a way. Gandhi had put an illusory hope of attaining Swaraj from the British before his belief in militant nonviolence, or so Roland claimed. Had he believed enough, Roland insisted, he would have gone to prison and begun a campaign to disarm the world. And that is precisely what Roland was trying to get Gandhi to do when he comes to see him in Villeneuve. But the reason why it doesn't work is that Roland does not understand Gandhi's contingent and ambivalent relationship to violence. Frustrated by the passivity of his countrymen, Gandhi had recruited for the Flanders slaughterhouse in 1918 because he preferred violence to emasculation and often said so. During Satyagraha campaigns, but not after Chaurya-Chaura, again, it was when Gandhi decided, he accepted that killing might occur and later even admired Indian terrorists with whom he engaged in debate for their courage while disagreeing with their tactics. He was not the pacifist moralist of Roland's imagination, but a political radical and philosophical anarchist. Nor was he a European-style humanitarian. Gandhi wanted to create moral agents more than he cared to preserve life. Hence his later direction to German Jews to die as Satyagrahis rather than submit to Nazi persecution. I mean, these letters are really extraordinary, the ones where he says to the Jews, you know, in the end you're going to get killed, so it's better to die and to go out into the streets, and you must die. Such practices of self-purification, and he believed they were valuable precisely because they exempted no one, even himself and his family. The so-called doctrinal rigidity that irritated Roland and that Roland tried to shift was in fact at the very, very heart of Gandhi's philosophy. What Roland wanted was a pragmatic leader to inspire European pacifism and resist the rise of authoritarianism. However, Gandhi was a nationalist who thought that India might serve as an example to inspire Westerners, but could do no more. They would have to struggle in their own way. He also lacked Roland's sense of urgency, as his own shifting timetable for British withdrawal from India illustrated. His program was not merely independence, but to make Indians ready for independence. Hence his preoccupation with the quotidian, food, handicraft, and prayer. And that's why every time there's a major campaign for Gandhi, he goes to prison and he comes out and he begins a campaign about spinning or the untouchables or food provision, because he believed that these were the two prongs of a movement that was absolutely inextricable. To Roland, however, these concerns appeared bizarrely out of touch with the tense and disintegrating political and economic reality. Moreover, he tried to convert Gandhi to his aesthetic philosophy in order to create universal tactics against coercion. In really beautiful letters, which were extraordinary, he tried to explain how beauty and spirituality were the same thing, that he, like the Mahatma, labored towards the same transcendent goals. He had already explored these ideas with Freud after reading A Future of an Illusion in 1927. Roland celebrated his vision of a so-called oceanic sensation, a feeling of oneness with the so-called eternal, which he saw as the fount of renewal and artistic creation. What for Roland was an impression of oneness, later channeled and often perverted by institutions and hierarchies, was for Freud nothing more but a futile attempt to reconnect with the mother and a regressive refusal to deal with reality. Freud and Roland disagreed over the value and meaning of the oceanic sensation, but each would have disagreed even more with Gandhi. Roland's search for universal urge detached from religious convention was different from Gandhi's commitment to his own Hindu birthright, even if he appreciated other religious traditions. Gandhi also recoiled from the Nietzschean odor that still wafted from Roland's infatuation with great men and was suspicious of great art. He often steered disciples away from artistic and intellectual pursuits. Indeed, he thought learning French was a waste of time and was contemptuous of interests that did not help achieve Swadeshi or self-reliance. Roland's commitment to great art meant he misjudged Gandhi's development of a different mass aesthetic. Toothless in loincloth, with walking staff or cross-legged before his spinning wheel, Gandhi cultivated a persona for the media to inspire the multitude. And of course, you know, it's still the great symbol of Indian national identity. Through this skillful manipulation, he created an image of spiritual wealth and physical puniness that was the opposite of the European strongmen. And I think it's interesting because he actually does go see Mussolini, but that's very much the opposite, the masculine hero. But I think that you also have to understand that Gandhi's very much in this world context of great men and charismatic leaders. Khadi caps that first proclaimed for their simplicity and hygiene during non-cooperation in the 1920s became a way to assert Indian identity. Men retired their regional headdress in favor of the symbol of national resistance, while Salt Marsh protesters garbed in white homespun defied British rule. And there they are, all in white. The charka, or spinning wheel, was emblazoned on Khadi flags. Gandhi succeeded beyond his own expectations. Khadi and spinning transformed colonial subjects into national citizens, and the cloth, with the cloth embodying both traditional artisanship and nationalist modernity. And there he is, with everyone in Khadi, spinning while at his political meeting. Gandhi contributed to the aestheticization of politics in India every bit as much as Mussolini had in Italy. And Roland had not really appreciated the nature of this extraordinary aesthetic that Gandhi had so much contributed towards. And there they are, the women, spinning. When Gandhi finally appeared on Roland's doorstep with Slade in 1931, however, Roland momentarily forgot all his doubts and was simply overwhelmed. Gandhi arrived in the foggy rain with naked legs, glasses, his odd toothless face emitting his distinctive nervous laugh, and his hand humbly joined in greeting, quote, "He leant his cheek against my shoulder and encircled me with his right arm. I had against my cheek the gray head, the shaven head with rough, wet whiskers. It is the kiss of St. Dominic and St. Francis." No doubt this was a strange pairing of saintly opposites, but for Roland, they came together through their common poverty and self-abnegation, and these were the qualities that he admired in Gandhi. There's no time to recount the near circus atmosphere of the visit. More important was the way the meeting highlighted their different modes of thinking. Roland had Gandhi entirely to himself, and Gandhi said not a word on his day of silence. He had instituted this, I can't remember when, but just as a means of being quiet because he lived constantly in public. His rat-like face attentive, that's a quotation from Roland, his teacup ears protruding. Here they are together. You can see Gandhi in his cotton cloth. It's freezing. It's absolutely freezing. It's the end of December. Just sandals. No, you know, it's very cold. For over 3 hours, Roland expatiated relentlessly on World War I, the rise of international capitalism, the armaments industry, and the dangers of fascism, especially in Italy. He heralded the proletariat as a force that could oppose the unbridled power of modern systems of production and exchange. Gandhi knew little about the Soviet system, but was naturally suspicious of communism's atheism and the violence inherent in any idea of class struggle. Already in this exchange, the beginnings of Roland's tilt towards the Soviet Union marked another growing divergence in their outlook. When he could speak the next day, Gandhi sympathized with Roland's, quote, great suffering over European turmoil, and praised the monumental effort he had invested in his analysis. But he confessed himself, quite simply, uninterested in such system making, and had no interest in history either. Quote, he said, my method is empirical. All my conclusions are based on personal experience. I recognize that there is in this approach the danger of illusion. The difference between those of a madman and my own is slight. The sages of yore have remarked upon experiences based on intuition, and they have been put to the test of history. I flatter myself that my own are not without foundation. The words laid out Gandhi's vision of the world, his belief in intuition, his distrust of Western rationality, and his conviction that political action without faith in God was unfathomable. Roland finally realized that his long-cherished hopes that Gandhi would lead Europe to peace were utter fantasies. The Indians' refusal to engage in intellectual discussion dispossessed a man whose career had been built on such exchanges. He wanted Gandhi's assistance in organizing the masses to give up his so-called aesthetic egoism, but Roland refused to relinquish either art or rationality. Indeed, Roland found it maddening that Gandhi was uninterested in European ideological disputes and was outraged that he insisted on going to Italy to meet Mussolini, despite Tagore's disastrous visit a few years previously. Gandhi admired Mazzini and, like many Indians, saw Italy as a sort of European India, a magnificent and enduring civilization later reduced to disunity and political paralysis. He wrote to Roland after the journey admitting that he admired Mussolini's reforms, which favored the peasantry and attempted to bring about coordination between capital and labor. He knew that the measures were quote, forced, but similar coercion was present, quote, even in democratic institutions. For Gandhi, Mussolini's fascism was not necessarily more evil than the sins committed by liberal regimes such as Britain, especially in the imperial arena. Again and again, Roland disagreed. He did not like Gandhi's insouciance over the hardship of Lancashire textile workers harmed by the boycott of foreign cotton. Gandhi was saddened by it, but he felt that compared to the poverty of India, their plight was much less. Gandhi's belief in handicraft and his rejection of technical advance annoyed him also. How, Roland asked, could he be more impressed by a peasant woman's loom, whom he visited and took a lesson from while he was up there in the mountains, than by the state-of-the-art medicine practiced at the Swiss sanatoria he had visited? In the end, like so many others, Roland could take no more. He disliked the Hindu chanting, was annoyed that Gandhi would not accept the offer of a car, and rejected the celebration of pain and sacrifice. He agreed with Gandhi that God was truth, but for Roland, the central element was joy, about which Beethoven had sung in his Ninth Symphony. Art, as Roland never failed to reiterate, was his God, and quote, the bread of thousands of souls. He reasoned beauty and art were imperative to making pain meaningful. Gandhi's joy was conceived otherwise in the harshness of sacrifice. The meeting was, in many ways, the high point of their relationship. After its failure, Roland and Gandhi followed different paths, and the impossibility of Mirabeau's attempt to follow both simultaneously became ever more apparent. When Gandhi took up the cause of the untouchables, she went to an untouchable village of Sindhi, built herself a cottage, tended the sick, and removed excreta, which was the job of the untouchables, so it was very important, and she was joined in this by Gandhi. She was never strong, but began to experience moments of independence. And here, I love this picture because it's the only one I have of her smiling. She was not the happiest of people. And I don't know exactly about this, what's going on here, but here she is with other Indian women, and she is smiling. She lectured in Britain in 1934 and toured America, where she met Eleanor Roosevelt, and they had a lot in common. They sort of came from the same social class. When she returned to India, though, Gandhi kept her away from him. because he was again suffering from high blood pressure, and she drove him absolutely crazy. Instead, he sent her to organize nonviolent resistance in Orissa in preparation for the Japanese invasion in World War II, and charged her with taking the Quit India Resolution to Allahabad for the Congress Working Party to debate. But they were imprisoned together until the war's conclusion, and were again reunited in Calcutta in 1947, where she spent three blissful months with him before he was assassinated. When he died, she refused to attend the funeral, not wanting to share her grief with the multitude. But his death was also a liberation for her. It released her from the dreary routine of spinning that had always tested her, and she instead took up animal husbandry. This failed, and she returned to her starting point, to Europe and to Beethoven, settling in Austria to write a biography she never finished. She was so impoverished by this time that it was only through a pension that Indira Gandhi arranged for her that she was able to survive. Her own autobiography stands as the greatest monument to her spiritual struggle and the heavy psychological costs of being both disciple, daughter, and co-worker, trying to operate in two very different cultures and political systems. Roland also pulled away from Gandhi's hypnotic influence after he failed to convert him to his view of East-West collaboration. Instead, he became ever more obsessed with fascism after the 1934 right-wing riots in Paris and the Italo-Ethiopian War. He visited Russia, intervened privately on behalf of persecuted intellectuals, but defended the Soviet system as the bulwark against fascism and disappointed admirers who believed he was no longer the so-called conscience of Europe. When the Popular Front was collapsing at the end of 1937, he left what he called immoral neutrality in Switzerland to call for a coalition against fascism in France. The Nazi-Soviet pact extinguished his last hopes, but he lived long enough, at least, to see the liberation in 1944 and died just a few weeks later. Gandhi believed that political change could only come with individual spiritual transformation and maintained that a confederation of craft and religious organizations all practicing their various visions of nonviolence would produce Swadeshi. In fact, he was always disheartened that many Congress activists preferred a modern industrial, even socialist India, not one of trusteeship, and desired constitutions and political institutions for which he cared little. Indeed, Gandhi had doubts about the UN Charter and the whole idea of human rights. He believed much more in human duties and obligations. He refused the pomp of Mussolini's Palazzo Venezia and Hitler's Berchtesgaden, nor was he like Stalin, who reduced his entourage to cringers, keen to copy his pigeon-toed gait. But Gandhi shared in the dictator's attempts to mobilize the masses and create unity in a deeply divided nation, producing a movement both enlivened by his charisma, but subverted by its magnitude. He wanted submission and freedom simultaneously, a disciplined army united in combating the British and creating an Indian Renaissance. But the ashrams were as much a cauldron of antagonisms as of service, where the usual sexual peccadilloes and financial peculations undermined his moral vision. He had to keep on closing them because they weren't pure enough. People like Mirabeau were crushed under the inevitable jostling that came from wanting to be close to the so-called leader. She yearned for a sexless intimacy with a devoted father, but may also wish for more. Gandhi was devoted, but only intermittently, and then impatient for her to become a selfish co-worker who left him in peace. He could not fully comprehend the painful longing that his sexual purity imposed on the woman dearest to him. Gandhi's body and its functions were revealed to the entire world, and even in this, it was extraordinary because his whole confessional mode was completely foreign to Indian culture. But he kept his sexuality cordoned off, inflaming desire in a way that massively increased his personal power. His outbursts reveal that he too failed to learn detachment. His disagreements with Mirabeau, therefore, did not stem from some ideal European, quote, bourgeois self colliding with a transcendent Eastern soul, as one of my colleagues who commented on this paper suggested when I was in Princeton. However, his belief in moksha, that the idea that he could be released from the cycle of reincarnation, was very important to him, and it strengthened him in his conviction that infinite otherworldly bliss was attainable. This sense of spiritual destiny was fundamental to his self-belief and political mission. Mirabai did not possess such spiritual confidence. She sought instead to please her two fathers, and in bringing them together, realized their and her own divisions. Roland approved of a Christian-Hindu pilgrimage for her, but refused such journeys for himself and believed them to be ineffective in the face of an imploding Europe. Gandhi was right, perhaps, that Roland overprized intellectual argument and that his so-called oceanic sensation was a meager spirituality for political transformation. Roland could not accept Gandhi's view that Italian fascism and then Nazism were simply intensified forms of violence intrinsic to Western civilization. Nor did he fully comprehend that the reform of Orthodox Hinduism was central to Gandhi's so-called spiritualization of politics. That's his own term. For Roland, all Orthodox traditions straitjacketed spiritual belief and creativity. He thought he had lit upon a new model for popular politics, hoping to adapt passive resistance to European struggles. But he never understood the Gandhian model derived from a potent combination of nationalism and Hindu revivalism, and believed that cosmopolitanism and the so-called oceanic sensibility would make an adequate substitute. In his villa in December 1931, he learned what he had already suspected, that Gandhi's nationalism and his anti-fascist crusade were radically different. Thank you.